Time for midweek conference now. And have you ever had the terrible news that somebody you love is going to die? It's never great and it's always hard to hear, and I can't imagine what delivering that information is like either. Chances are you may have found yourself in this position, perhaps a friend or a family member with a terminal illness, cancer perhaps. Maybe you've had some experience with doctors and other health professionals who have to break the news to people that they're dying. Maybe you're one of those health professionals. If you are, how do you give people an idea of what they might have to prepare for in their final days as well as deliver the information? I can't imagine it's an easy job telling people they're going to die. And I'm also guessing that some people do it better than others. I'm wondering if you're listening, if you've had any experience of this. How did that end-of-life conversation go with the doctor? Did you find there was help available? 1300 222 702 is the number to call if you'd like to join Midweek Conference today, because Dr. Ursula Sansom-Daly from the University of New South Wales is here. And Dr. Sansom-Daly is leading a global team to develop a training program for healthcare professionals on how to have these conversations, particularly with young cancer patients. Dr. Sansom-Daly, welcome to Drive. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, it's such a hard conversation to have, whether you're a loved one, whether you're a family member. I can't imagine it being your job to tell people that they're dying. How do health professionals do that?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. It is such a tricky conversation to be able to have, and I think, fortunately, in Australia and internationally, we are in a point now where most young people and most cancer patients do survive. So it is the minority of our work. But in saying that, it is still probably one of the trickiest things that any health professional would ever have to do. And I think that's probably one of the things that gets in our way as well. So obviously, they're difficult conversations for a young person to even fathom having, let alone parents, families, boyfriends, girlfriends. But then for a health professional, that's also can be really anxiety provoking. I mean, I think, in some of the work that we've done, I've seen that, whether it's a 16-year-old being treated in a children's hospital or maybe a 21-year-old being treated in an adult centre, either way, the clinicians can have a really hard time with it, because either way it feels so unnatural to be maybe faced with a young person who maybe won't be lucky enough to survive their illness. And I think there are huge barriers that get in our way being able to deal with the distress of opening those doors and having those conversations.
It's horrible to have to be judgmental with this, but how does a good conversation go when you're a health professional and you have to break that news to somebody? What is the gold standard way to do it?
Yeah. So I think internationally now there is recognition that what we need to be doing is having these conversations in a timely way. So that means in enough time that the young person and the family can, make the choices that they might want to make, have some of those decisions. If there's a bucket list they want to be able to tick off, or if there's things they want to be able to have a say about in terms of treatment or, where they might want to die. So having them in a timely way and in an age-appropriate way. So in a way that's at the level of the young person, that they're involved and that their voice can be heard. So that's the standard that we know we should be aiming for. In practice, there's never a single formula for these things, is there? Everyone's different. Every young person's different. So in my experience, in my clinical role as a psychologist working with young people with cancer, when I've seen it done best, it's almost been a sort of a team effort. So, oftentimes it'll be the doctor, the senior doctor, who'll lead, the medical side of things in terms of, usually talking about, where treatment's headed, treatment goals, where the treatment's working and what that looks like. But you've got a whole team of people behind that, nurses, social workers, psychologists and other allied health professionals. And you can never predict with a young person or any patient really who they might connect with, especially out of that team. And so I think what's really important in this space is actually that it's not just doctors, but it's actually the whole multidisciplinary team of clinicians who feel comfortable being able to open that door. Because you never know, it might be a radiation therapist in the waiting room that the young person decides to, ask a tricky question of, or it could be a nurse at 3 a.m. on the ward that they decide to open up to. So really it's about the fact that we need to upskill everyone working with young people to feel comfortable.
And when we're talking about young people who have a terminal illness, what sort of age range are we talking about here?
Yeah. So in Australia, when we talk about adolescents and young adults with cancer, we're very specifically talking about 15 to 25-year-olds. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of the main ones is that, our youth cancer services around the country that cater for the adolescents and young adults, that's the age range that they kind of cater to. Internationally, that age range differs a little bit. And so with the grant that we're doing, we're partnering, the Global Accord grant, we're partnering with experts from around the world in this endeavour. And in different countries, it's a slightly different age range. So in the UK, I think it's 13 to 24. In the US, it's 15 to 39. So it's slightly different depending on where you are. But I think the common thread with this age group is that it's those teen years, those emerging adult years when, young people are really establishing themselves, and from psychological, cognitive, emotional perspectives, they're sort of on the trajectory towards adulthood, but perhaps not quite established in the same way that an older adult would be.
Is it more difficult to get the message across to people who are young, who are dying? Is that why we need a program, a grant, and a program project like yours to try and improve the way that health professionals communicate that information?
I'm not sure if it's necessarily more difficult. I'm not sure how we would quantify that, but it's got unique aspects working with this age group. I think internationally, the adolescent young adult age group's been brought into focus in recent years for a number of reasons, one of which is that their medical outcomes have lagged behind older adults and also younger kids to some extent. So in this age group, we do see that some young people will suffer from more, poor prognosis, rare cancers that don't necessarily respond the same way to the same treatments that an adult might get. So there's been medical reasons why we've focused on them, but of course there's the psychological reasons as well. I do think there are, psychological and social factors that mean that it's quite difficult for a young person to grapple with these sorts of ideas. It's quite natural. I mean, if you're 16, chances are you've never met another person who's maybe had cancer. You've certainly probably never seen someone go through that end-of-life phase or perhaps die. And so that's all quite foreign to you. Whereas I think someone in their 60s or 70s, it's no less tragic if they're facing that end of their disease. But they've got a bit more familiarity with that life script, so to speak. So they've kind of got a sense of how those things go. And I think that might sometimes help them being able to have some of those conversations a bit more readily.
You're listening to Dr. Ursula Sansom-Daly from the University of New South Wales. She's leading a global team to develop a training program for healthcare professionals on how to have end-of-life conversations with young patients, with people up to about 25 years old who are dying. And I wonder if you're listening, if you've had any experience of this. What did doctors say to you? Was there much help for you? Were you just given a bunch of pamphlets? Do you think, given your experience, there's a good way to tell somebody they're dying? Maybe the health professionals you were dealing with had one. 1300 222 702 is the number to call, or you can text in on 0467 922 702. The text from a listener in saying there were dedicated counsellors in the emergency section of the hospital, in intensive care as well, and dedicated palliative care places that give great support. Obviously, though, with what you're working on, it's a broad brush approach for health professionals rather than people who specialise in palliative care?
So I think one of the issues, so we do work with absolute experts in palliative care, and obviously they're excellent at this sort of thing. Exactly. It's the bread and butter of what they do. I think one of the issues with young people with cancer that we sometimes see is that they don't always meet those palliative care specialists earlier in the course of their disease. And what we know about these conversations is that when they work best, often it's not just one conversation at the sort of crisis point at the end. Often it's best if you kind of build up to it, gently, with a number of earlier conversations about less confronting things, but about things like, pain medication, or about, quality of life, what things are important to you, for the young person, what hobbies and activities do they really want to try to maintain, those kinds of more lifestyle type things. And then you build up to those kind of real sort of critical conversations towards the end. And so I think it's great to have those experts in palliative care, and I'm so lucky to work with a number of experts, and we have some of those on our team developing these guidelines as well. But I think it's not it's not enough for us to kind of put it in there to do or in their basket that they just look after it. Because really, as I was saying before, I think it'll work better if everyone's equipped to be able to have those conversations.
Damien's called in. Good afternoon to you, Damien. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Chris. How are you going?
Well, thank you. What was your experience of having a child with a terminal illness?
Yeah, look, it was a pretty harrowing experience, as you could imagine. It was nearly 10 years ago, but without going into too much detail, the support from the medical staff medically was fantastic and really they did everything they could. But I guess in hindsight now, looking at the way that it was kind of broken to us that there was no hope and that we would have to, say, you know, switch off life support for our daughter, at the time, well, actually, afterwards, we kind of felt like we had been ambushed a little bit. And it wasn't prefaced with anything. I guess in our hearts we knew that it was probably inevitable, but we always were holding out. But it was kind of just we had a meeting and we sat down at a meeting and suddenly all the ICU doctors sort of came in. We thought, this is a bit strange. And then social workers, and I guess it was then that they broke it to us. And to be fair to them, they were very good and they were very, very professional. But, you know, I wonder now in hindsight whether there was some palliative stuff that might have been able to, we could do better psychologically with us. Obviously, it was heartbreaking news. I don't like to be too critical, but I think there are definitely aspects of that could have been done a hell of a lot better.
What do you think would have helped you, Damien?
I think perhaps some intervention earlier, and to be honest, it's quite difficult at the time to try and accept maybe some palliative care. We had post-palliative counselling and things after our daughter died, which was fantastic. And once we had that, we kind of thought, gee, that would have been great to have had that maybe for the last, you know, couple of months when things really started to go quite badly, and it may have just softened the blow a bit. I don't know, Chris. It's very difficult to sort of know in hindsight, but I just know at the time it was kind of like a ton of bricks when it came down, and we did feel like it was kind of like the information was held back until all of a sudden it was just like, well, we can't hold back any longer. We have to tell them. And maybe could have been done more gradually.
Mm. Yeah, it's very difficult, I guess, but there's the other side of it too. They call you into a room and they tell you that your daughter's dying. How is that ever going to be great news? It's just awful for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And like I say, at the end of the day, there's no easy way to do that. And regardless of how the blow is softened, it's always going to be difficult. But perhaps it allows you, as time goes on, leading up and afterwards, to deal better psychologically with it. I don't know. Like I say, that's the way it was for us. And I guess, you know, we dealt with it in our own way. And the post-care was magnificent. But, you know, beforehand, I'm not sure. I haven't got answers, but I know at the time it was very, very difficult, and like I said, felt like that it was kind of just almost not so much blurted out, but kind of like, you know, a little bit of an ambush.
Yeah, Damien, thank you very much for the call, Dr. Sansom Daly. You know, listening to Damien's story, is there a way for people to be eased into the idea that a son or a daughter or a young person is dying, rather than leaving, you know, as Damien said, as well-intended as medical people were, feeling ambushed?
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your story, Damien. It's such a difficult time. And like you said, there's no sort of easy way to have this conversation. But I think that it, in a way, leaving it to that crisis point at the very end does make it harder, though. And totally understandable why people do that, though. And the thing Damien touched on there is the thing of not wanting to give up hope or lose hope. And on the professional side of things, they also don't want to feel like they're taking away any hope. But I think that there are ways that we can sort of open the doors to some of those conversations earlier on. And I think if you do it earlier, what can be easier about that is that it's still a bit more hypothetical. When you're sitting in that ICU room and it really is very clear that there is nothing more that can be done, at that point it's all very real and very intense. And also at that point, there's not much left in terms of time to make choices or, you know, other decisions. So I think as tricky as it is, if you can start opening the door to, you know, hypotheticals, you know, if treatment didn't go, started not to go the way that we're hoping, are there things that would be really important to your family, to your son, to your daughter, to make sure that we try and achieve? Or, you know, for young people, it might be a case of, you know, we know that there's so many procedures and treatments and you're getting poked and prodded, and there might be some of that stuff that if you could avoid it, you might want to. So, you know, is there a situation where actually you'd want to put your hand up and say, actually, you know, that's enough for me right now. So it's really tricky. And I think the thing that's tricky about this for clinicians is, you know, all of the amazing clinicians that I work with, hearts of gold, and absolutely know that this stuff needs to be talked about. And I think oftentimes it's just, what's the language that we use to actually get those words out of our mouth at the right time?
And I guess also trying to judge how much information patients actually want.
Yes.
Because I would imagine there are instances where people, you know, want to know so much, but not all of it. And then there'd be instances where people want to know all of it. How do you make that judgment?
Yeah. And look, that's one of the trickiest things of, you know, working with humans and people in healthcare, is that no one patient or family is the same. And it's always that delicate dance of really paying attention and being attuned to what does this patient want right now. And so I think that comes back to just really listening and asking a lot of good questions. And, you know, with young people, teenagers, 16-year-olds, 18-year-olds, 20-year-olds, they are often quite good at telling you what they want and don't want. And so I find it's often just helpful just to ask them. You can say, you know, there's some information I have, there's some stuff that I've found can be useful to talk about, and I've found it helpful with other patients I've worked with, but you tell me what's going to be helpful for you.
You're listening to Dr. Ursula Sansom-Daly from the University of New South Wales. She's leading a team that's developing a training program for healthcare professionals on how to have very difficult end-of-life conversations with young people. And particularly, Alison's called in with the other side of this, the clinical side of this. Alison was a nurse and may still well be. Alison, good afternoon to you. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you. Yes, when I was a very young nurse, I worked in intensive care, and I remember having to speak to a family whose son had just died, and asking to donate his organs. And it was a terribly painful situation. I remember sitting and crying with the family and then being berated for being upset. And I left that era of nursing soon after because... And I'd like to think there's a culture of supervision, of taking care of nurses working in that sort of situation. I know psychologists and social workers have a culture of supervision, but I'm not sure that nursing in palliative care areas and intensive care really take that seriously. Just how the toll it takes on nurses, particularly young nurses, when working with families and people who are dying.
Thanks for the call, Alison. Are we getting better at doing that? Are we getting better at looking after the staff who are dealing with these sorts of situations?
Yeah, it is a really tricky thing, and I've observed that myself. As Alison says, I'm a psychologist, and within our profession we have a sort of a supervision kind of built in, which is very fortunate. And I've often felt that nurses and as well junior doctors can be really left in a difficult spot dealing with some of the stuff without that kind of support. I'm not sure... you know, whether or not we're getting better. And I think it differs a lot depending on, you know, the local team that you work with and the hospital that you work with. But I think that, you know, one thing I'm hoping that we might be able to achieve with some of this training is if we can support professionals better, you know, provide the infrastructure there to support them better to have some of these conversations, that might actually help, you know, potentially filter through to, you know, different levels of you know, staff being able to support each other.
Andrea called in. She couldn't stay on the line, but she wanted to say that when her father-in-law was dying of cancer, she felt like the doctors weren't willing to say, look, it's not looking good. She felt that the family really had to ask the doctor very definitively before they got a straight answer. It's that vexed question, isn't it, you know, about how much information do you give people, or is that an instance where, you know, maybe the doctor felt he couldn't make that judgment at the time? Is that the way that it works? Do doctors wait until the very last minute until all hope is extinguished?
Look, I think that's, again, really variable depending on the doctor. And I think that different doctors, different levels of experience and different personalities, we all carry our personalities into our jobs with us as well. So I think there's a lot of variability in terms of what doctors do. And certainly I've worked with some amazing doctors who are great at this. I think that one thing that is sort of evident in this particular area, though, is that it does seem to be an area where patients and families will tend to wait a little bit for particularly doctors and the healthcare team to take the lead a little bit, you know, both because... there's an assumption the doctor knows what's happening best with treatment, which, you know, is quite right. But also because it is such a daunting conversation to open up. So I think, most times patients and families, and particularly young patients and families, will wait for a doctor or a senior nurse or someone like that to kind of open the door and kind of show them the way, I suppose, in terms of, you know, how to explore this terrain. When I've had the opportunity to open some of these conversations with young people, sometimes the response I've gotten is, I actually have been thinking about a lot of this stuff. I've had all these questions and things floating around my head, but I just didn't know what I was supposed to kind of think about or decide about or what questions to be asking myself. So often patients and families are actually thinking about a lot of this stuff already. So it's about how do we as clinicians make a safe space for them to explore that. And it's not an either or with hope either. I think the best way to do this is to be able to kind of continue to maintain the hope that we can. You know, obviously no one wants to give up on the best case scenario of treatment working and all of those sorts of things. But it's about also simultaneously building up a realistic path forward if some of that stuff doesn't come to pass.
You're working on new guidelines for health professionals having end-of-life discussions with young people. Is there much out there right now for people? I mean, it's obviously going to take you a little time to develop this up. Is there much help now for clinicians?
Yeah. So I think what we've seen in recent years is, there's increasing focus from the government. People or bodies like the Clinical Excellence Commission have all kind of highlighted the importance of advanced care planning conversations and having those timely end-of-life conversations. And so I think what there is out there, and internationally as well, there's best practice guidelines saying that we need to be doing this for paediatric palliative care. So what there is kind of statements around this is what we need to do. And I think the missing link is perhaps how do we translate that into clinical practice? So how do clinicians on the ground, you know, turn that into words and conversations that they can use? So one of our amazing collaborators on this Global Accord grant, for example, Dr. Laurie Weiner, she's from the National Cancer Institute in the States. And there are things like booklets, advanced care planning booklets that do exist for young people with cancer. And so we'll be looking at all those kinds of things to see, you know, does it help to use kinds of, packageable, like booklet type interventions to help structure some of those conversations? Is that a helpful thing? We'll be looking at all kinds of different training supports to see what's going to be useful for a range of different clinicians and in different settings as well, because what we know from international data is that the type of hospital that you work in, the type of team you work with, that all affects how these conversations play out as well.
And they sound like they're difficult ones. Nick's called in with some insight on that. Nick, good afternoon to you. Your wife works in neonatal intensive care. She must have had some very tough conversations over the years.
Yeah, she has. I remember one time I was saying I was quite upset about something and she just looked at me and, like, blankly and just said, well, imagine what it's like trying to tell a beautiful couple that their child's not going to make it. It was quite, I don't know. Emotional. I get emotional about it because she gets quite upset. Yeah.
It must be hard if she comes home from a day at work with you and she's had to do that, Nick.
Oh, she'll be silent. And it just affects the family. You don't know how to approach it.
Mm. Has she been able to get much help at work with care for herself when she's had a day like that?
No, they don't mention it, or it's just part of the job, and they need to suck it up and get on with it. And I don't know, I think it's just very bizarre that they've put in the situation where pretty much, you know, they need to look at it as a battlefield, but they're the frontline troops, and they're there doing all this hard work. And
Nick, has she thought about maybe getting out of that particular unit and into something else? Has she talked about that, or is she really dedicated to what she's doing?
Oh, she's been. Sorry, I'll just get myself together. She's been very dedicated. She's done some amazing work. And just seeing sometimes how she feels. Yes, she's retrained herself, and I don't want to say too much because it'd be obvious to some people in the field who she is. So, because she's she's been doing teaching and teaching neonatal, and she's done that quite a bit, and she's got back into the hospital side of it again, and then now she's looking at teaching again. If that makes sense.
Well, it sounds like she has a lot of wonderful knowledge to pass on to young students, particularly. Nick, thank you so much for the call, and hats off to your wife for the incredible work that she's done. I mean, there you can see the clinical toll that it takes on people. And Nick's he's a husband, but, you know, he's watching his wife go through that, and you can hear the emotion in his voice when he's talking about it.
Absolutely. It's so difficult. And I think one of the things that we really want to achieve with this work is, you know, we're partnering with Canteen here in Australia, Teenage Cancer Trust in the UK, and Teen Cancer America. They're the sort of three pioneers funding this work. And I think, you know, I'm very fortunate to work in a specialist centre where we deal with young patients all the time. And so I'm surrounded by colleagues who have a lot of experience in this. But we'd really like to develop sort of guidance and supports for clinicians who are working, say, in regional centres where they don't see this all the time, where they might be feeling more isolated, like potentially that last caller.
Yeah, well, they're helping Nick, and then wonderful neonatal nurses like his wife. It sounds like she's isolated, may even work in a big city hospital for all we know.
Sure. Yeah.
Dr. Sansom Daly, best of luck with the work, and best of luck with developing what you're trying to do for health professionals, having those terribly difficult conversations about end of life. Thank you so much for coming in for Midweek Conference.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Ursula Sansom Daly from the University of New South Wales, a grant recipient to develop clinical guidelines on how to tell people that they're dying. Cannot imagine how difficult that is.